Sky, wind south at 12, 75 degrees Kenosha, 70 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Before we get to today's program, we want to remind you that the morning show is available to you not just as a broadcast, but also as a podcast in which you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Subscribe by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available on all of the major podcast provider platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Greg Reberg.
I am honored to be speaking today on the Morning Show with a conductor whose work I have long admired. And for those of you who have listened to the classical music programming here on WGTD over the years, you have heard me play many, many recordings by Maestro John Malcheri. He is both a conductor and a scholar, taught for many years at Yale University, a Grammy, Tony, and Emmy Award-winning musician, and with many other awards on his shelves as well. He has presided over a number of important recordings, including many in which he really helped to unearth the original versions or full scores of pieces that were maybe long misunderstood. And he is also one of two conductors who presided over Decca's groundbreaking and award-winning series called Entartete Musik, or Degenerate Music, which presented to the world world premiere recordings of various musical works that were banned by the Nazi regime. A champion of works such as Leonard Bernstein's Candide, Gershwin's Girl Crazy, Kurt Weill's Street Scene. On my shelf, among many recordings I enjoy so much, one called Hollywood Dreams that features a number of sort of rare treasures unearthed by Maestro Malcheri. He also is responsible for my single favorite musical theater recording, a beautiful recording of The King and I with Julie Andrews and Ben Kingsley. And in addition to all of that, he is also the author of several very interesting books, and most recently, a new book called The War on Music, Reclaiming the 20th Century, in which Maestro Malcheri tries to help us understand the current state of so-called classical music in the world, and particularly in this country, and what he sees as a glaring void in the repertoire that is typically played by orchestras and sort of championed by academics and critics and so on. And he believes that there is a huge swath of important music from the 20th century that is largely neglected. And were it not to be neglected, were it to be a vibrant part of our classical music repertoire, he believes that the current situation would be dramatically different than it is. That explains the subtitle of his book, Reclaiming the 20th Century, in a sense reclaiming some of this music which has been sadly neglected. The book published by Yale University Press, again called The War on Music, and Maestro John Malcheri, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Glad to be here.
It is so interesting to see you on my humble little laptop screen, a face that I've seen on a number of different recordings and on various television broadcasts and so on. Thank you again for making time for this conversation. I'm just curious, at what point during your really busy musical life did you decide that you also wanted to make time to sit down and write books? And how in the world did you manage to do that amidst your pressing musical schedule?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I mean, and a really good one. I've always been writing, you see, Greg. I've been writing since I was in junior high school. My brother, who's 3.5 years older than I am, was in high school, and he was feature editor of the high school newspaper. And as he said, he was desperate. So he asked his kid brother to write reviews. Now, I've been going to concerts, theater, and opera since I was very, very young, growing up in New York City and having one aunt, Aunt Jenny, who brought me to Broadway, and Aunt Rose, who brought me to the Metropolitan Opera. So I was, and plus the fact that television in the early 1950s included everything. So it was not unusual to see the NBC opera. So the first opera I ever saw and heard was Madame Butterfly on television. And, you know, that was next to female roller derby, right? So we had everything. So as a kid, I was just inundated and fascinated by all these programs. I mean, there were drama programs. It's just an incredible list of what we could see and what was accessible. And of course, it's also hard for people to know that, but it was totally free and it was available to us. So, over the years, I've always been writing, and I've been curious about the music, that what we play, how we play it, what additions. You know, music is you know, it's listed among all the arts, but we kind of lump them together as the arts. But music is really quite different from the other visual arts, because most of them are visual, you know, or sometimes in the case of poetry or literature, because it requires, one, a translator. In other words, you have to hear it in order to know what it is. Therefore, it needs somebody to take it from the notes on a page, in the case of classical music, to actually your ears. And the other thing about music is that it's invisible. So because it's the only art that's invisible, though it can be used to accompany ballet, it can opera, it can tell kind of stories with visual components, the thing itself is invisible. So, and I suppose tertiarily or maybe primarily, it's an invention. I mean, it's one of the more mysterious human inventions. We humans are mimics. Certain animals are mimics too, but we love to hear something and repeat it. And that's how we learn language. It's how we learn a lot of things. But I think significantly is that we are imperfect mimics. See, a bacterium can replicate itself exactly. And that's what that is. It's kind of like the early form of xerography. But we are not so good at it. We like to do it, but we don't hear the end of words. We don't necessarily whatever. And so that's why we have Portuguese and Spanish and Italian and Romanian, because it's very bad Latin, but really good Italian, right? And then Italian is created, and then people start making rules, but a Sicilian speaking Italian is quite different from a Neapolitan, or more important, someone from Turin. So because of that kind of desire to repeat, and we love to repeat, and because music is invisible, why we have all this different kind of, how it develops over the years has always been interesting to me. But because, you know, I started out in college, actually in high school as a composer, but I started becoming more interested in music that we've never heard and why we don't hear it, or the music that we have heard, what version of that music are we hearing? We conductors have the extraordinary responsibility to climb into the costume of Beethoven, climb into the world of Mahler. You know, if you love the Sistine Chapel, you can look at it, but you can't change the color. You can't change how big the fingers are of God and Adam. You just can look at it. With music, because it requires translation, you can focus in on some detail by simply slowing down or bringing out the violas to elucidate or illuminate what we feel the composer is saying. You know, what does the music mean, and what is the music saying? These two things are the battle between what you might call Dionysius and Apollonian, because Apollo will say, well, let's look at this thing. And Dionysius said, let's just go for this feeling of it. You know, when I worked with Leonard Bernstein for 18 years, I would have thought that everything was about Dionysius, you know, about the passion that he brought to his performance. But the first question he asked me at Tanglewood in 1971, when we had lunch together, I was about to conduct for him, and so were the other students. He said, what is the relationship between the slow introduction of Romeo and Juliet and the Allegro? I went, what? He wanted, and he said 2-1. And he said, I believe that every masterpiece has a single tempo in it from which all the tempos are derived. And I thought, wow, you know, that's the last thing I would have expected from Leonard Bernstein, right? So so why do I write? Well, I've been writing, and I've written program notes. When I was music director of Scottish Opera, for example, every production I conducted, I wrote something about it. I think something happens to me, and I suspect every performer, I guess, I don't know, it depends how articulate you are or how you think. But when I'm in Mahler 5, or I'm in La Boheme, I'm actually in it, I'm rehearsing it, I'm climbing into its costume, as I say, I'm now in it. Yeah. I know things that I didn't know from having just been an audience member. I know things. I start to realize, why is Mimi's Mi chiamano Mimi so haunting and strange, whereas we're getting feedback now? Oh, I am. That's very strange. I don't know why that suddenly happened, but I'll do this again. When I'm it's fixed. When I'm climbing into, say, La Boheme, and I realize that, what is it about Mimi's music that makes it so different from, say, Rodolfo's? They each have an aria when they meet each other. And also, what happens in that opera when Rodolfo is alone? I mean, Act One of La Boheme is, well, the most difficult opera in the standard repertory to conduct. And I could explain that later, but that's not why we're here. Okay, so something happens here. And what is it? So when you're in it, you realize, oh my God, Mimi's music is based on the Tristan chord. In fact, when she faints, that is the climax of the Tristan prelude. It's exactly that harmony. And Puccini is telling you she's going to die. That's the famous love-death chord, as it were. That's the thing that, you know, it's the residue of Tristan, if you had to take it down to one simple idea. Okay, but Rodolfo, is his music in Che gelida domani is French, because actually he's a poet and we are in France. And you can look at also the climaxes of those two arias are very specific in dealing with sexual climax, the difference between a man and a woman, as imagined by Puccini. So now I'm inside that. When I get away from it and I'm just listening to it or we're talking, I tend not to know that anymore. So that's why I write. I write things like what I learned from conducting Oklahoma or West Side Story, or indeed Sicilian Vespers by Puccini or Mahler 5. And so that all turned into something, my first book called Maestros and Their Music. And that started because on the day that the New York Times, and I'm a New Yorker, so I look at the New York Times as my local newspaper, I read it every morning. The day that the New York Times announced that Pierre Boulez died, there was a picture of him on the front page, and there was in that edition two obituaries. There was a third obituary of another conductor called Gil Kaplan. Who is Gil Kaplan? Gil Kaplan was a multimillionaire who loved Mahler and used his money to learn how to conduct a symphony by Mahler, the Second Symphony, even though he theoretically couldn't even read music. And both Gil and Pierre recorded Mahler II in London and in Vienna. And they both get obituaries. And I thought, this is worth a book. How could two completely opposite people, as it were, be dealt with as important conductors when you would think that conducting would mean you be the height of understanding and technical ability and insight? So that began Maestros and Their Music, the art and alchemy of conducting, in which I talked about my experience and the experience of those conductors I know. It wasn't meant to be biographies of different conductors, because I leave people out, of course, because it wasn't meant to be that. It's about what our lives are like and how the choices that we make. After that book, Knopf asked me to write about music. They wanted something a little bit like Aaron Copland had written, a kind of eternal book about what is music and why it matters. And that's called For the Love of Music. And again, I decided there was a moment where the book started happening, Greg, because I bought a single ticket in Carnegie Hall to hear Daniel Barenboim and his Berlin Orchestra perform the Bruckner Ninth Symphony, a symphony I particularly love. And I had a single ticket in the last row of the top balcony of Carnegie Hall in the middle of the winter. And I took a picture of the stage because in the first half, Danny played a Mozart piano concerto. And we had this little orchestra sitting on the stage of Carnegie Hall with the piano. And what it was like to be in an audience of strangers, and you say hello to the person to your left and the person to your right, then maybe you start to think of who else has sat in this place since the 1890s when Peter Tchaikovsky opened the hall. And we're all strangers, and we coalesce to watch and listen to and celebrate Danny Barenboim. After the intermission, there is this... The stage is full of people. There are eight horns now with Wagner tubas. And now it's the size and shape of this is an entirely different experience. And when you get to the last completed movement of the ninth, Bruckner is writing knowing that he's terminally ill. And as I say in For the Love of Music, we are at the gateway of life and death when we experience Bruckner's Ninth Symphony. And then I remember this afternoon that I was there in the winter. And then when we were done, you know, we all climbed out, we went down the stairs, we went out in the streets of New York, and we dispersed. And for a while, we were all carrying our program, and we were a unit of people who had been uplifted. And then we spread out into the streets of New York, some in the subway, some in the car, some walking. And that was the beginning of the second book, For the Love of Music. Now, the third book, which is really why we're here, which is called The War on Music. Actually, that one has been building for 30 years. I dedicate the book to Michael Haas. Michael Haas is a former record producer at Decca. And you mentioned Entartete de Musique, the degenerate music. I said, for Michael Haas, who in 1990 asked, why, John, after a half century, do we not play the music Hitler banned? Now, 1991 is when Decca formally announced and began recording music that Hitler had banned. Many first recordings, and I was one of two conductors on that series. The same year, the Los Angeles Philharmonic created the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra for me. I mean, I got a phone call, would you be interested in a new orchestra at the Hollywood Bowl? And I said, yes. And so then what happens is that I say in 1990, and I remember telling Leonard Bernstein that the Thursday night before he died on a Sunday, I told him about this orchestra that was being created for me. And after Lenny's funeral in the Dakota, I remember, you know, saying goodbye to my family and Jerry Robbins and various people who were there, of course, his colleagues, his mother, his children, and getting into a cab and going to the airport and going to LA. And the next day was the announcement of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Well, while I'm sitting on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl, I say blithely, we're going to explore the music written in Los Angeles. Now, why did I say that? I said that because I was aware that the Los Angeles Philharmonic did not, in the 1930s and 40s, play the music that was being created and composed, not only in Hollywood, but also Stravinsky's music and Schoenberg's music. Remember, in those years, we had the two fathers of modern music, Schoenberg and Stravinsky, living in Los Angeles. I mean, you could never have predicted that in 1913, right? You know, Rite of Spring, 1913, Pierre Lumiere, of Schoenberg, 1912. Who could have thought that you know, that in the 20 years later, 25 years later, they'd both be living in Los Angeles. Okay, so I say, we're going to play the music written in Los Angeles. Okay, but now I have to learn what that is. So I'm getting a list from Decca, names of composers who were on the list of banned composers. I'm also learning some of the history of the composers who you would call the patriarchs of Hollywood in the 1930s, when music to sound film was being created. You know, what was that music? And I found that the names of many of the composers in Hollywood were on the banned music from Hitler. And that was the first time I could make this link, that somehow Hollywood and its composers were linked to World War II and the racial policies of the Third Reich. And as it turns out, also Mussolini. And so there was this gigantic learning curve. So now I start to explore these two gigantic repertories and where they coalesce. I say in my book, The War on Music, there was a moment when I was learning Eric Korngold's 1927 opera, Das Wunder der Heliana, which had never been recorded. This is in the 1990s. At the same time, I'm learning Korngold's music to The Adventures of Robin Hood. Two completely different environments, same composer, two different delivery systems. One is an opera house, one is a movie. And yet, these two masterpieces were calling to me across time, because you, maybe not you, but I suspect most people listening, grow up being told that Hollywood music is basically garbage, that the composers weren't real composers. They were, I don't know, they stole music from Tchaikovsky and Beethoven and Wagner. They were not particularly talented, but they did it for the money. And then you find out that what I call the patriarchs, the seven patriarchs of the classic film scores, were all students of the most rigorous conservatories in Europe, with one exception, who studied in New York. And you go, well, wait a minute, why would Miklos Rozsa be considered a lesser trained musician than anybody else you could think of from that time? Whereas he went to the Leipzig Conservatory. I ultimately saw his grades, which were all excellent. Why would Max Steiner, who was the first composer really to write music for sound films, when Max Steiner was growing up in Vienna, at one point he did a four-year course in the conservatory in 1 year when he was 14. These guys were geniuses. They were at the very top of their classes, whether it was in Dresden, St. Petersburg, Berlin, Vienna. They come to America, why? Well, they almost all of them come to America to flee the Nazis. They're all defined as Jews by the Nazis. They're not practicing Jews particularly, but their family history is Jewish. And they create the most heard orchestral music of the 20th century by writing for the films. And yet we're all taught that they're charlatans. Why is that? So that became a kind of a mystery to be solved. And why don't we play that? Why is their music pops music, or music that we don't even review? We don't even have a critic who can review the quality of film music except to say it isn't any good. You use the name Hollywood music to say something's bad. Well, okay, why is that, right, Greg? So that's why I write, because I think, as you pointed out very nicely, I've conducted a lot of different kinds of music and a lot of different venues. So whether that's Broadway or the Boston Pops, or whether it's the Metropolitan Opera, or you know, the Chicago Symphony, and whether it's Alban Berg's Lulu, your great grandfather, obviously. I've conducted three productions of Alban Berg's Lulu, but I've also conducted Madonna singing Don't Cry for Me Argentina for the movie of Evita. And because I have this very varied career and experience, I thought it would be important for me to connect those dots and to write a story about the music that we've lost and why we've lost it.
I think one of the most valuable points you make in your book is at a point in the book when you actually turn your gaze earlier to the 19th century, yeah. And you talk about two of the giants of that century, Wagner and Brahms, and how so many were anxious to create what in many ways is kind of a false binary.
Yes.
That is, either you love Wagner or you love Brahms, but they are from two different planets. They are drastically different from one another, opposing schools. And of course, there are some very, very striking distinctions between them. But in this chapter, you point out that actually they were connected in many ways and actually had a mutual respect that nobody ever talks about. And certainly at the time, nobody seemed to be aware of. And it seems to me that that is one of the abiding themes of your book, is this notion that we are attracted to splitting things into black and white. This is good music. This is not so good music. And your book is a call for us to not be that lazy and to not fall into that trap.
Well, that's right. It is a trap. It is a convenience, by the way. We create categories because it helps us navigate what might be otherwise chaos, right? And so we create this and that. But for example, before I got to the Wagner-Brahms issue, because just for your listeners, what people don't know is that Brahms collected manuscripts from other composers. He was the first to do that. So he had a manuscript of Bach. He had a manuscript of Gabrielli or whoever. He owned manuscripts of Wagner, right? He bought Wagner, his handwriting, and it's a scene from the Paris version of Tannhäuser. So we have that, and when Wagner learns of this because he's collecting his manuscripts, he writes to Brahms and asks for it because he says it can't be of any interest to you, assuming that Brahms hates his music, and that. Those four letters are so moving to me, to quote in the book. But even before I learned of that, and of course, Brahms, just in case people are curious, before they read the book, Brahms, of course, returns it and asks for something in return. He asks for a copy of the Meistersinger. Right. So already we know that Brahms is completely aware of what Wagner is writing. And Wagner writes back and says, well, it's sold out. But I hope you don't mind. Here's a leather-bound copy of my Rheingold, which was used at an exhibition. And it's, you know, it's leather-bound, and it's been abused because lots of people have touched it. And he writes in the score to Brahms, to, you know, Johannes Brahms, a much-used score to replace an ugly manuscript, because the manuscript had been used by the French engravers to engrave the parts for the Paris opera. So it was covered with, you know, cigarette butts and who knows, wine and stuff like that. Then Brahms writes back to Wagner, this almost this love letter of admiration. Now, even before that, when I was a producer on Your Toes by Rodgers and Hart, which is a musical for your listeners, they may not know, written in 1936. And in 1983, I put together a revival of On Your Toes with the original director, George Abbott, who was 96 at the time, with George Balanchine, who was 87, the original orchestrator, Hans Bialik, also 87. They were alive and they remembered everything. So in that time, the role of Peggy Porterfield was taken over by Kitty Carlisle Hart. And Kitty said to me, you know, I was dating George Gershwin in the 1930s. Now, this is a little long story, but follow me. George Gershwin was living in Beverly Hills at the time, and so was Kitty. And he proposed marriage to me, she said, but I didn't want to be Mrs. George Gershwin. I thought I was going to be a big movie star. But he would come back, she said, from playing tennis with Arnold Schoenberg, and he would put all this music paper on the floor explaining to me the 12-tone system. I had no idea what he was talking about, but he was very enthusiastic. Okay, now this is even more serious than the Wagner-Brahms issue. Now we're talking about the 20th century, where George Gershwin, in the last year of his life, is studying music with Arnold Schoenberg after they play tennis together every week. Now, I remember at that time saying, if George Gershwin and Arnold Schoenberg didn't make a you like this or you like that, why should we? Why can't I love George Gershwin's music and love Arnold Schoenberg's music? It's a personal choice. Now, again, so the more I learned, the more I felt the need to write The War on Music. Because, I mean, I'm glad it took me 30 years to write, because even though I thought the book was finished about a decade ago, I couldn't figure out one part of it, which was the Third War, you know, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. I couldn't figure out why, when I went to Yale as an undergraduate, as a freshman, I was being taught serial music, 12-tone music. It was the only kind of music. I mean, I was getting the history of music, but the history of music was taught to me, like most people, as an ever more complicated history of music getting more and more complicated, which is what justified the march of music. So you can look at Beethoven as being more complicated than Mozart, and Wagner being more complicated than Beethoven, etc. But there's a certain point where that didn't make any sense to me, because once you've hit saturation point, it's like how much sugar can you put into the water until it hits saturation. Then you have to figure out a way to supersaturate it in order to, you know. Well, when you hit the point where every note can be played and every rhythm in a dance piece can become unpredictable, because what is dance music? It has to be predictable rhythmically, otherwise you can't know where you put your foot next, right? So the Rite of Spring in 1913 made dance music that you and I could never dance to. And in 1912, Schoenberg wrote Pierrot Lunaire, which is basically a song cycle that you and I couldn't sing anymore. So once you hit this point, the idea that things would get more and more complicated was a theoretical criterion, but not a practical one. Because all of those composers who hit that saturation point went away from it. And after they hit saturation, they simplified and created their own personal language. And I started thinking about that. Kurt Weill's early music is non-tonal, and then he writes Three Penny Opera and Mahagoni, not to mention Broadway musicals. In fact, the first person to do this is Richard Strauss. Richard Strauss, before there was Schoenberg, there was Strauss. And he hits total density in the moment where Elektra recognizes her brother Orestes, in that moment where she goes, Orest! And wow, and I remember conducting that. It is like, you know, being hit with a wind machine, what you're doing. After he writes Zalame and Elektra, what does he write? Der Rosenkavalier. So you can argue that each of these composers, whether that's Aaron Copland or whether it's Igor Stravinsky, and even Schoenberg, move away from that idea that things should always get more complicated. Same thing with Hindemith. And you can go through this list. Same thing with Shostakovich. Yes, you can blame Stalin for that. On the other hand, you can thank Stalin for that, because not only did Shostakovich figure it out that his style didn't have to be provocative, that he didn't have to write an opera about rat poisoning and murder and even erectile dysfunction. They're all in Lady Macbeth of Mashinsky. And then he writes the Fifth Symphony. And not only does he write the Fifth Symphony, which is a triumph on every level, because he gets to write 10 more symphonies and die in bed. And he becomes one of the most played and beloved composers of the 20th century. So on one hand, I try to explain why the model didn't work anymore, but also how it was that in the Cold War, we in the West, we at colleges, we at universities were meant to embrace atonality again, the avant-garde. And why did it become the official language of what we call the West, as opposed to the Soviets, who were our enemy, who were portraying themselves as the culture center, become a communist, become part of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, because we have Tchaikovsky, we have Mussorgsky, we are the culture of the West. Ironic, considering what's going on right now, where they see themselves somehow as the East and versus the West. So that took a while to figure out, and I think I have. The effect of that was to eliminate music that all had to do with the World War II and also did not adhere to the idea that the avant-garde is the only way forward, that the provocative is the only way forward. That's true in how we produce our operas. They should be provocative as opposed to united in what they look like, what they sound like, and how they're directed. Instead, we're meant to provoke, which is very much an idea from 1909 with the Futurist Manifesto. It's a very old idea, the so-called avant-garde. The avant-garde is definitely a derriere garde, as far as I'm concerned. And the result is we've thrown out hundreds, if not thousands, of works that would link us to the 1930s and 20s to our own life today. And that's my point here. It's a call to play the music. Play the great music, this uplifting, beautiful music. It's complex. It's unique. Each composer has his own voice and her own voice. That's part of what we're exploring. And I believe that the repertory that you and I love, which we all agree is the classical canon, should not have ended in 1920 or 1930. Where are the masterpieces that link us to 2022? And if you start to look at what they are and you wonder, where did they go? Who's the greatest living Italian composer, ladies and gentlemen? Who's the great, you know, what do you, in 2001, I was teaching a class at Yale and I had about fascism and socialism and the Nazis and the effect on music. And I said to 24 very smart Yalies, who's your favorite living composer? And there were crickets in the room. I mean, you could hear the wind blowing through the trees. And I said, isn't that a cause of concern? And one undergraduate raised her hand. She said, John Williams. Now that was brave, because in 2001, the idea that you would even consider a Hollywood composer as a greatest living composer was practically unheard of. And I said, now that's interesting what you just said. I said, because right now, John Williams is waking up in Los Angeles and he is working on 3 film scores. And you will remember your year here by the music that John Williams was writing as you and I are talking about this history, and probably not a number of other composers whose names you will read about.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned John Williams, because an interesting point in your book is when you talk both about John Williams and also the Italian composer Ennio Morricone, and how they are both renowned for their film scores, but they also write scores for the concert hall.
Yeah.
But they are drastically different in the way that they approach that. That when you listen to the trumpet concerto of John Williams or any number of concert works by Morricone, you would never guess that it's the same guy who wrote the score to The Mission or the score to E.T. or whatever. And it's like they see... Yeah. That is two vastly different pathways of making music and keep it very distinct with each other. I think you quote Mr. Morricone as saying, I write very differently out of respect for the genres. That right. Somehow it would be disrespectful for them to write music for the concert hall that sounded like their movie music. And yeah. I think your book is essentially saying that's a shame. And that's
yes. Yeah. That's exactly, that's right. So when Danny Elfman told me he was writing a violin concerto, I said, of paramount importance, Danny, is to keep your voice. Don't try and do something that you think is going to please somebody who's got some criterion. You know, Victor Herbert wrote such great operettas, but when he was commissioned by the Met to write Natoma, he wrote something that he thought would sound important, right? And so as a result, we don't, you know, it doesn't work. Now, John, on whom I love, I mean, you know, who can say anything bad about John, but he has that view that concert music should have an entirely different kind of language. Whereas, so Danny's violin concerto, which I'm proud to have recorded, is Danny, and Danny expanded so that the melodies require whole movements. And I think he's a good example of how a very famous composer can still use his own language or her own language to write long form music. I mean, take the inspiration of, say, George Gershwin, who always sounds like George Gershwin, whether it's the opera Porgy and Bess or his piano concerto. He doesn't suddenly put on somebody else's clothes. And I also think that this was one of the tragic results of Leonard Bernstein, who lived in the middle of the raging raging arguments about what is serious music and what is popular music. So we have West Side Story, which is one of the great, great works of the 20th century. And then when you get into Lenny's more complicated things, because he could write as complicated as anybody, you're still looking for that voice that you love so much. And I feel badly that he, for many reasons, that he didn't live longer. And because he would have come out of that. And I think he would have. In fact, the book, The War on Music, in a way is a 21st century response to Lenny's Harvard lectures. You know, the Norton lectures, the unanswered question. I said, you know, what Lenny was in the middle of that battle. He was trying to prove that tonality is normal, is what we want. Having conducted all of the most contemporary music at the time. And he was, so he was trying to find out a way to explain it. He was using language theory, you know, Noam Chomsky, music is a language. But I think that the unanswered question is in fact, the answer is that basic question. The answer is, why does non-tonal music or provocative music, and I'm not talking just about 12-tone, because I know people don't write 12-tone music anymore, but they write non-tonal music, which doesn't seem to have a direction, and nor does it have usually melody. And when there is a melody, a critic will accuse the composer of writing a melody that sounds like John Williams, as if that's a bad thing. So we're still living in this period of time where you say, stop, you know, we have lost so much music, so many operas, so that continued. You know, Puccini dies on an operating table in 1924. And that was lucky in a way, in a horrible way, because had he lived longer, he would have been the number one composer for Mussolini. He would be the proud official composer of the fascist era, as opposed to Mascagni, who became that person. But because Puccini died in 1924, which is just 2 years after Mussolini came to power, he managed to escape any smell of fascism. So Turandot, 1924, left incomplete, is the last Italian opera in the repertory. Now, we have to like go, okay, I didn't fight World War II. I wasn't a fascist. I wasn't a Nazi. I wasn't in the Soviet era. What is the music people wrote? And I think there was such an overwhelming and understandable reaction at the end of World War II by Germans, Italians, Austrians, not to hear any of the music from that time. And one last point, if you think of the German and Austrians, and that's why the epilogue of the book, The War on Music, talks about four Austro-German composers, whom I consider the greatest. Now, I don't know all of them, but I would consider these probably the greatest, who are Kurzweil, right? Arnold Schoenberg, Erich Wolfgang Korngold, and Paul Hindemith. What happened to them? All of them escaped. All of them came to America. All of them wrote music during the war and after the war. That music, and they all died as American citizens. So you're a German. It's 1948. You're living in the rubble. And Paul Hindemith has written four or five symphonies in the enemy country. What do you do with that music? Because if you say this is a masterpiece, then you have to confront the fact, well, we probably would have put him in jail. You know, what do you do with Kurzweil's Broadway shows? Well, how do you deal with that? How could he write such beautiful music? We're living in the rubble. Schoenberg writes some music that isn't atonal. He writes beautiful, a string work in G major. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with Korngold, who not only his writing in Hollywood, but these guys are probably seen as rich, right? They survived, they escaped, and we are living in the rubble. So there's a moment after the war where Germans, Austrians, Italians just say, okay, we can't deal with this. Let's go back to Aida. Let's go back to Beethoven's Ninth. And let's skip right ahead to the most modern music that confronts that era. So, and the result is we've thrown out wonderful operas, symphonies, you know, so much music, and we should just play it.
You write at one point, an entire generation of music was eliminated by the passionate feelings of the vanquished.
Yeah.
And in that same portion of that chapter, you call a lot of this music inconvenient music.
Yeah. That was not even my word.
Huh?
Yeah. That was a word from Christoph Lieben, who ran the Konzerthaus. I said, Christoph, this is back in 1997 when we were playing Korngold. It was the first time a Korngold concert was being played since the 1950s. And I said, why don't you play this music? I asked this question, right? He said, because this would be the inconvenient music. And this ironic word of inconvenient, because to accept its genius is to accept the fact that a country that prides itself in creating classical music would have perhaps killed their greatest composers, composers who they hailed in the 1920s, who escaped in the 30s, and then in the 40s and 50s had to be eliminated from being played. Now, when I discovered the Hindemith symphonies, and Hindemith, you know, is box office poison because people tell you that the music is bad. Those symphonies are fantastic. They're uplifting. They're funny. They're sad. They're beautiful. My call in the book is to the greatest of us, the most famous of us, the biggest institutions, for them to play the music. Just play the music. I can only do what I can do. I'm not that famous or even famous at all, but we have our leaders. You know, right now on Broadway, Daniel Craig is playing Macbeth. Somebody who played James Bond is playing Macbeth. Lots of people go to see James Bond play Shakespeare. I'm saying the equivalent of Daniel Craig in our classical music world, whether that's the Berlin Philharmonic, whether that's Petrenko, whether that's Danny Barenboim, whether that's Gustavo Dudamel, you know, the people who are the leaders and those institutions, they should take their responsibility, the Metropolitan Opera, La Scala, in producing and playing this music. Because, Greg, if you don't hear it, you can't judge it. That's the part about music. I'm not saying it's all great. I'm saying give it a chance, ladies and gentlemen. You might love it. You might not love it. That's okay. But it depends on us to translate it, to give it to you, to play it and say, I want more of that. And that's my point.
The book again is The War on Music, Reclaiming the 20th Century. It's published by Yale University Press, and the author, Maestro John Maccheri. Maestro Maccheri, it's been a great honor for me to speak with you, and it was a great pleasure to read your fascinating book. I think you make all kinds of tremendously important points, and I hope many people will take this book in hand, and I hope it will be a force for good as we go ahead from here. And thank you for being my guest today on The Morning Show. I'm so glad we had this conversation.
Thank you, Greg. Lovely to be with you.
Monday on The Morning Show, best-selling author Dan Hampton, author of a new book called Valor, the astonishing World War II saga of one man's defiance and indomitable spirit. Speaking of Dan Hampton, he has written what is perhaps the definitive book about Charles Lindbergh's historic 1927 flight across the Atlantic. The 95th anniversary of that is coming up a week from tomorrow on May 21st, and in the podcast version of The Morning Show, I will replay my interview with Dan Hampton, author of The Flight. Looking ahead again to next week, on Tuesday, Keenan Lowe, a former NFL coach who went back to his hometown of Oregon to coach a struggling high school team there, and then became a different kind of hero when he confronted and disarmed a would-be mass shooter in his school. His book is called Hometown Victory, A Coach's Story of Football Fate and Coming Home. Next Wednesday, award-winning journalist Jory Lewis talks about her book, Slaves for Peanuts, A Story of Conquest, Liberation, and a Crop That Changed History. Next Thursday, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to The Morning Show. Her guest, Brandon Corder, an expert on mosses. And 1 week from today, I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Trevor Young, longtime public servant for the city of Racine, despite being a very young man. He is now transit manager for the city.